an errand, and the chauffeur had not returned when the interview was completed. Moses asked the visitor to drive him down to Captree, where a boat, a big cabin cruiser belonging to Adam Karp, a consulting engineer who had grown rich on Moses' fees, was standing ready to take him out for blues. And as they walked down the steps of the cottage to the author's car, Moses did something that made him feel for an instant that the man walking behind him was not Robert Moses, but Paul. The author had, unknown to Robert Moses, spent time with his dead brother. Paul Moses had managed to keep his chin up, even in discussing the misfortunes of his life. But sometimes, drifting into reveries during lulls in the conversation, he had, unconsciously it seemed, uttered a phrase, a sigh, almost a moan, that hinted at the depths of the melancholy within him. A painful, reflective sighing, "Oh, ho, 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 oh, ho, ho, ho." The author had speculated that so unusual an expression might be inherited from their father. But in all the times he had previously talked with Robert Moses, the author had never heard him make that sound of discouragement and something close to despair. But he made it now. For Robert Moses had lost none of his ability to look into other men, and he had apparently looked into William J. Ronan. R.M.'s aides were sure he would shortly get the assignments he had been promised. Shortly after the author talked to Moses at Oak Beach, Harold Blake, Moses' male secretary, assured him, "They want him to get done with the current TBTA program as fast as possible so he can help expedite the overall MTA program. I think Ronan wants him to help cut the red tape." But Moses appears from the first to have known what was really in store for him. According to Blake, Ronan almost never telephoned his predecessor, who was still sitting in his office up at Triborough, hoping to hear from him. Moses sent him memos on matters he felt needed Ronan's attention. Some Ronan passed to lower-level aides for replies. Others were simply ignored. The new MTA chairman did not bother even to acknowledge their receipt. Moses' aides understood that they were no longer to report to him. They had not, however, fully understood that they were not to talk to him, at least not about Triborough matters. But, following the takeover, this was quickly made clear to them. Says one, "A couple of times I mentioned to R.M. some things that Ronan's aides had told me to do, and he didn't like the instructions at all, and he telephoned Ronan to complain. And word came back to me that Ronan didn't like that at all. And I mean, what could I do? You couldn't say to Mr. Moses, 'Now don't talk to anyone about this.' It was easier just not to tell him what was going on." Soon his former aides were avoiding his office. Said Blake, "It's sad to see a guy who used to be in charge of a place still there, but not in charge anymore." And there was to be no start on the Sound Crossing in 1969, or 1970, or 1971, or 1972. There were various excuses from Rockefeller's office. In 1969, the bond market was soft, and the issue couldn't be floated at feasible rates. In 1970, there was a gubernatorial campaign, and, with the affected sections of Long Island and Westchester up in arms against the bridge, the governor didn't want to be put on the spot. In 1971, it was financing problems again. In 1972, a legislative campaign, and the governor didn't want to damage Republican chances to hold control of the legislature. With each delay, Moses was assured that next year would be the year the big project got underway. Moses was fooled by the fact that Rockefeller himself wanted the Great Bridge built. He was fooled by the fact that the governor had promised publicly as well as privately that Moses would be the one to build it. Once, as a sort of test, Moses leaked to a reporter the fact that he had been promised the job. The reporter contacted Ronan's office, and Ronan himself said that that was indeed the case. He was fooled most of all by the fact that it was simply inconceivable to him that he would not be allowed to build it. He had conceived it, chosen its precise location and the routes of its approach highways. He had directed the planning and blueprinting. He had, in a sense, since it was Triborough's money that would back the bonds that would pay for it, raised the money for it. It was no more than one more link in the chain of bridges linking the island with mainland, Triborough, Whitestone, Throg's Neck, that he had planned decades before and had been building ever since. It was his bridge. To let someone else build it and take credit for it would be an injustice of an enormity he seemed unable to grasp. It took a long time for realization to sink in. But, as the years passed, it sank in all right. It gradually became clear to him that they weren't going to give him the job. The governor wanted the bridge built, he came to understand, but he would not let Moses build it. It might, considering the public and private promises, be too raw to assign the direction of the huge task to anyone else, so he would simply wait to get the 5-year job started until Moses, aging, was no longer able to embark on it. It gradually became clear to Moses that the governor and Ronan weren't going to give him any job, that despite all their promises, they were not ever going to give him anything to do, that they were just waiting for him to grow old and die, or go quietly away somewhere. Then the old man grew desperate. He had almost no leverage left, except for the fact that Ronan couldn't get things done, and there were people around who, for their own purposes, wanted things to be gotten done. He used this leverage frantically. Recalls Brennan, "I've had other people, professional architects, the engineers, come to me and say, 'Gee, couldn't you do something? Bob is going crazy that they're shelving him.' They don't say they were asked to talk to me, but they were." He talked to Brennan and Van Arsdale himself. He tried to put on a good front, but the two hard-eyed unionists saw through it. "He tells us he could have been on the MTA board, that he turned it down himself because he wanted to be free to do construction. But maybe that's just his pride. He's nothing. He's a consultant, and he's not even being consulted with." What Robert Moses, once so arrogant and powerful, was doing was begging. Begging them to help him get a little of his power back. He had been reduced to pleading, and he was, to these men who had known him when, almost pathetic in his pleas. "He's getting edgy," Brennan says. "He tells you that he knows he's being kept out of things. He's mad at dragging things out like they're doing. He tells us that things should be underway now, and meanwhile costs are going up. He complains that these people have no guts. He talks about the program, about his frustrations that things aren't moving, how they should be doing this or that on the bridge, taking borings or whatever. He never talks in terms of getting him back in. It's in terms of the program. It wasn't on the basis of him, but getting the job done. He's taking this very hard. He's a hard, crusty old guy, but he's sensitive." Brennan and Van Arsdale responded as Moses had hoped they would, and so did various contractors, engineers, and architects who had entree to Rockefeller or Ronan. For they were afraid that without Moses, public works would never again be constructed in the New York area on the scale that had made some of them rich and others of them powerful. "As far as the MTA is concerned, there's nothing moving, no doubt about it," Brennan said in 1970, more than 2 years after Ronan had taken over. "There's no roads being built, there's nothing being built." Speaking of Ronan, the red-faced, white-haired, blunt unionist tries to keep the contempt out of his voice, but it keeps seeping in. "Ronan tells us that the planning on the Second Avenue subway and tunnel is in the hands of the city, and that it's being held up by the mayor and the city planning commission. He says the MTA is ready to move on it as soon as the city lets him. As soon as the city lets them. Jeez! And that would be $1 billion, too. Or Ronan tells us it's $1 billion, too. So they fought for him. Said Brennan late in 1968, I say we, people in the industry, those of us who know Moses and have been trying to keep his hand in these things, feel there is no question there's people trying to sidetrack him. We're hoping they'll realize he's needed. It's silly to take him and put him on a shelf. We've been talking to the governor in Ronan. The architects, the engineers, the contractors have been talking. We're going to try hard. But, Brennan said, it's going to be tough. He's not in the power position he used to be in. The governor says that he put Ronan in there, and Ronan is boss. Bill Ronan says, oh, we want to use Bob once we get going. We say, what do you mean, once you get going? You need to plan now. Assign guys to things. When we press him, the answer is then very vague. So I can see that it's just a snow job. They want him to get tired and to go away and get lost. But I say, forget it. This guy don't blow away. And the sad thing is that a lot of people who like Bob Moses are saying he's too old, and it's not a bad idea to ease him out because of that. But he's not too old. He's got fantastic ideas on housing. The old man was reduced to publicly praising Ronan and his boss. In 1969, at a time at which Moses and his aides were privately ridiculing Ronan's failures to get the MTA program moving and the deterioration of the Long Island and the other commuter railroads under his direction, Moses said publicly, as to Nelson Rockefeller, he's no cautious Calvin Coolidge. He has put his reputation on the line. The people voted for his $2.5 billion program. They could not have expected instant results. So put away your flying bottles and slingshots and give Bill Ronan a break. He tried to take advantage of every opportunity to see them in person, at dinners or dedication ceremonies, for example, to engage them in conversation and try to make friends with them. The governor was always charming in return. Often these two men would stand chatting in public with their arms around each other. Ronan's manners with the old man left something to be desired. He let the boredom he felt show. Watching Moses try to curry Ronan's favor once, Harold Blake muttered bitterly about the MTA chairman's smug college professor look, but then added with resignation in his voice, he, Moses, wants to stay in public life, so what do you do? Swallow your pride. But nothing he could do helped. Rockefeller and Ronan stayed bland, and the bridge stayed unbuilt, and Moses' memos still went unanswered. He had to suffer also what was for him perhaps the ultimate humiliation. He had to know that people knew that he no longer had power. Because his power had never come from anything as clear-cut and publicly understandable as an election, it took a long time for even many political insiders to realize that he had lost not only some power, but all. More than a year after the MTA reorganization, Jack Lutsky, now a judge, was told that Moses was out of power completely, and he refused to believe it. He telephoned Liebwald to check, and, hanging up, said with a wondering sigh, "You're right." But eventually they all realized it. He could see pity in the eyes of those of them who, like Lutsky or Wagner, were capable of pity. "I feel sorry for him," the former mayor said one day after sitting next to him on a luncheon dais. "He enjoyed power so much. He should have become a private citizen. At least then he could have spoken out." He could see contempt in the eyes of others. When, at a dinner party, he would launch into one of the interminable monologues about past accomplishments to which people had once listened with respect, people grew bored. There were 1,000 little hurts. Once he invited Bronx Borough President Herman Badillo, whom he had never met, to lunch on Randall's Island. Badillo called him Bob. For just an instant, the big head went back in the old haughty gesture with which he would have once withered any guest who dared to use that familiarity without invitation. Then one could almost see him remembering that he needed any ally he could get. The head came down, and he went on with the conversation. Piled on humiliation, frustration. Age was not a consideration in Moses' thinking. He absolutely refused to talk about the birthday, reported a Daily News reporter interviewing him on the occasion of his 81st. "Birthdays are a nuisance," he said. birthdays are to forget. He was always talking about de Gaulle and Adenauer, and how they were older than him, and age wasn't affecting them, Shapiro recalls. And Moses had an example closer to home if he wished to use it. His grandmother, Rosalie Silverman Cohen, the Granny Cohen of family legend, whom he so closely resembled in manner, had been intellectually alert until the very day she died, at the age of 93. Physically, the years had left their mark. The deafness was very bad indeed. He now required eyeglasses for reading, although he whipped them off whenever a visitor came into the room. Liver spots had mottled the olive skin. He had a paunch now. But it was not a large mark. Above the paunch, the shoulders were still broad, the chest deep, the arms muscular, incredibly muscular for a man in his 80s. His physical presence was still dominating. Wrote the Daily News reporter, "He's a big man, not so much in height and weight as in presence, and even now, on the eve of his 81st birthday, he's got enough vitality and power to become the instant center of attention when he walks into a room. Even now, it's easy to see why they called Robert Moses a giant." Mentally, there was no mark at all. "Aside from his deafness," said a former associate who hadn't seen him for 20 years, "he hasn't changed at all." His mind had lost little of its monumental capacity, its voraciousness for knowledge, all knowledge. Books were piled in heaps around the Oak Beach cottage. And in a single pile, a visitor saw the latest Simenon, Ratay's History of Long Island Hurricanes, O'Casey's The Plow and the Stars, and an old, worn Boswell's Johnson, so old and worn that it might have been the very volume through which the young Bob Moses had first begun to idolize Dr. Johnson at Yale. One afternoon, Moses' chauffeur delivered to the door Mary the First's sister, Emily Sims Marconier, carrying 3 books for him. None was particularly good, she said, although Mary Renault's The Mask of Apollo wasn't bad. "Well," he said, with his warm, charming grin, "let's see how bad they are." The following evening, the chauffeur returned the 3 books to Mrs. Marconier, all read. More and more of his Newsday columns were columns of literary criticism, some of it very perceptive indeed. His intelligence was still a creative, shaping intelligence, still roaming vigorously the length and breadth of the metropolitan region. It still saw in everything, as it had seen on the walks with Francis Perkins almost 60 years before, ways to make it better. Moreover, freed at last of the crushing day-to-day political and administrative responsibilities, that intelligence was free to contemplate, to reflect. Moses' imagination, in shackles so long to responsibility and ambition, was loosed again to dream and plan in leisure, as it had dreamed and planned half a century before, when, with all other planners baffled by the urban recreation problem, it had, looking at Long Island, conceived a revolutionary solution. Within 1 year after his ouster from power, Robert Moses possessed what he had not possessed during the years in which he had been building housing, a unified, comprehensive housing program. It would be simple in concept. Because the principal barrier to urban renewal programs was tenant relocation, new housing should be built where there were no tenants, in vacant areas of the city. After it was built, tenants from slum areas should be moved out of the slums, out of whole slums at once, into the new development. The areas they had vacated, now empty, should be raised, and new housing should be built there. Then residents of another slum area should be moved into that new housing, their area raised and rebuilt, tenants from still another slum location moved in, until all the city's slums had thus been replaced with modern housing. Dedicating Co-op City, the 15,382 apartment community, largest apartment development in the United States and largest cooperative apartment community in the world, that he had played a key role in conceiving and organizing, he offered as a visible, palpable, large-scale demonstration of the efficacy of his plan, a proposal for an Atlantic village at Breezy Point that would dwarf even Co-op City, providing schools, shopping centers, playgrounds, and a 3-mile-long public beach, as well as 50,000 modern apartments looking out over the ocean, while, incidentally, solving the city's dilemma over what to do with that valuable long piece of beachfront, hitherto fought over by park and housing advocates as if the building of one would preclude the building of the other. Financing? Ingenuity and boldness would solve that problem, as it had on the West Side Improvement, he said. He had several alternate methods already worked out, and after the buildings were opened, into them should be moved 50,000 Bedford-Stuyvesant families. Then that ghetto area should be rebuilt, and by repeating this process, in 10 years, there will be no more ghettos. Moses had a citywide program worked out, right down to specific sites. Among them, Welfare Island, air rights over the Sunnyside yards of the Long Island Railroad, and a vast, unused tract of Bronx parkland near the Whitestone Bridge. And costs. $5 billion could clean up every slum in the city in 10 years. It was a typical Moses plan. No consideration of the city investment required to provide facilities for these new, isolated communities, or of whether the city could afford such investment. No concern that by isolating low-income people by the tens of thousands, he would be creating new ghettos. But he did not see these flaws. His plan was large enough in scope to deal with the immense slum problem, the only plan that was. He was sure it would work. He was as enthusiastic as a boy about it. And he could not restrain his impatience with those who criticized it. The Lindsay people have had their chance to solve this problem with their scattered sites and vest pocket things. None of these fancy words are going to solve the housing crisis. Only lots of new houses will solve it, and this is the way to get lots of new houses. He was so anxious to be given a chance to prove he was right. Housing was not the only area in which he had plans. In every conversation now, as Vollmer put it, there is this concern growing for so many things left undone, so many things to be done. What people didn't understand was that everything he had done was part of a plan, a dream, a plan planned and a dream dreamed decades before. Large parts of the plan were realized, but larger parts were not, including some of the most beautiful, some of the ones he most wanted to realize, some of the public works he had been trying to build for decades. His cottage might face the Robert Moses Causeway and Robert Moses State Park. These were two achievements that should have been enough to content any man. But what he saw when he stood on the porch of the cottage and stared out was not the bridge and the park, but the road, the great Fire Island Highway, that the bridge and the park had been supposed to bring closer to reality. The road still unbuilt. His dream had not been merely of an ocean parkway and a belt parkway that ran along the water for 40 miles. His dream, dreamed so clearly in 1924, had been of a great shorefront drive all the way from Staten Island to Montauk Point, 160 miles. A drive whose heart would be the Fire Island Road, bordered on one hand by bay and on the other by ocean. A highway along which people could drive almost literally among boats and waves, the most beautiful drive in the world. That road would be built one day, he had no doubt about it, and he wanted it to come while he could still see it. He wanted to build it himself so that he could be sure it was built right. He had built parks in the city, but the greatest waterfront park, the Jamaica Bay development that he had conceived of in 1924, was still not built. He had reserved for future generations so many great tracts of Long Island land, the Marshall Field Estate that had been renamed Compsit State Park, the Southside Sportsman's Club that had been renamed Connaquit State Park. But it wasn't enough. There were so many more country clubs and big estates that must be saved from the developer's bulldozer and preserved for the public. And despite his pleas to his successor on the State Council of Parks, Lawrence Rockefeller, to Duryea's successor as head of the Long Island Commission, A. Holly Patterson, to county officials of Nassau and Suffolk, to philanthropists, to anyone who would listen, No one was doing anything to preserve them. He had built great urban highways, more great urban highways than any man in history. But where were the greatest of the highways, the expressways across Manhattan Island that would complete the expressway net and alone make it workable? There were 100 big things left to do and 1,000 small. He had put Lincoln Center together for the Rockefellers, and then they had goofed up by not providing ramps and wider roadways from the West Side Highway.
"They don't grasp the problem. They don't even remotely grasp it," he said one day.
He could take care of it in a couple of months. And if it wasn't taken care of, you were always going to have an access problem there. The walls of his office on Randall's Island were covered with pictures of his achievements, pictures of bridges and dams illuminated at night, and through the window behind him could be seen the solid concrete and steel of the Triborough Bridge. But the office was dominated by a huge map of New York City, and while that map was crisscrossed with the solid lines that represented achievements built, highways, bridges, tunnels, on it also were lines, many lines, that were not solid but broken, lines representing achievements not yet built, dreams yet to be turned into reality. As he sat at his desk, that map, its width wider than his arm spread, its height taller than a man, stared back at him, reminding this man, to whom accomplishment was so important, that there was so much yet to accomplish. There was visible behind his urge to keep building an element almost of desperation. The public was doubting the wisdom of his creations. The way to convince them was to complete the system, to build more highways, more bridges, more housing, to build, 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 in a frantic attempt to rescue his reputation. But there was behind the urge also genuine creative drive, a drive undimmed by 80 years of life, the shaping impulse of the shaping man, and a drive supported by the arrogance which, since his youth, had told him in a voice that would not be denied that he had the answer to the problem, that he knew what to do, if only he were to be allowed to do it. What made his situation more frustrating still was that the problems that needed solving were not being solved. His city, the city he had thought of as a product he had created, was, he felt, being destroyed by the men who had succeeded him in power. Hoving and August Hechter, grandson of his early benefactor and Hoving's successor as park commissioner, had had their opportunity to institute their park policies designed to return the parks to the people. After 5 years of such a return, the parks were ruined, in as bad shape as he had found them when he took over from Tammany Hall. Little new housing was being built. The slums were getting worse. No highways were being built. Supposedly this was because the money was being spent on mass transportation. But at the rate mass transit facilities were being built, they would never solve any transportation problems, if indeed most of them were built at all. Democracy had not solved the fatal dichotomy. He did not see the problem as a dichotomy, but only as a failure on the part of public officials to understand the realities of the situation, that the public say on public works must be limited and in general ignored, that critics must be ignored, that public works must be pushed ruthlessly to completion. Understanding this, convinced that he had the plan for the salvation of New York, he schemed and twisted and turned to get the power to do it. Ass-kissing, pompous, double-chinned Ronan and his arrogant boss. Asking allies, fewer each year, as more and more architects, engineers, and contractors were pulled into the Rockefeller-Ronan orbit, to intercede for him. Frantically, he tried to get the United Housing Foundation interested in the Atlantic Village project, and to put him in charge. In one desperate ploy to do this, he planted an interview with the Daily News, which appeared, under the hopeful headline, "Greatest Urban Renewal Ever, Re-enter Bob Moses," in a story favorable to the plan, and closed with a broad hint of who should run it. Moses, whose only job at present is that of consultant, was asked during the interview whether he might consider himself just the non-political man for the job.
Will you take any direct part in this project? He was asked.
Nobody has asked me, he replied.
Nobody did. His agile mind, always so quick to find avenues to power, twisted and turned and darted at every one that he felt might open up, and, with the city's mayor and the state's governor unalterably opposed to him, found them all closed. Rockefeller and Ronan kept him firmly on the shelf. His impatience, the same terrible impatience he had had as a young man, turned into frustration, a deep, gnawing, terrible bitterness. As this man, who had measured off his life in days each of which was vital, looked back on weeks in which nothing had occurred to advance his plans, as weeks turned into months, as he realized that he had been 79 when he lost power and that he was now 82, or 83, or 84, he fell into violent rages. His conversation revealed more and more foreboding of the ultimate. He had thought Oak Beach would be his Elba. Was it to be instead his St. Helena? Was he to die without ever getting the chance to build another bridge, to redeem his name? He could have used the time to write, and publishers approached him with substantial offers for an autobiography. But he had not the patience to write, nor the desire, and it may be other considerations militated against it as well. A key to Moses' ability to buy men had been his ability to keep the purchase secret, and the seller's confidence that he would do so. He could hardly write a story of his life without going at least to some extent into the machinations by which he had obtained power, and were he to reveal them, men whom he would need to get power back might shy away from him. He did come up with a book, published in 1970 by McGraw-Hill, Public Works, A Dangerous Trade. But this was not really a book at all, and it was certainly not by Robert Moses. A vast volume, 952 pages, 90% of it consisted of documents already in the public record, reprints of speeches, press releases, brochures, reports, newspaper and magazine articles on his triumphs, letters to and from prominent persons. And most of the remainder was written not by Moses, but by members of his staff. There was no triumph in its publication. It was extensively reviewed, but reviewers treated it for what it was, a non-book. He could not sit still. Reading in the afternoon, he would jump up from his chair, yank on his old corduroy jacket, and stride out onto the long wooden porch outside the Oak Beach cottage, pacing back and forth, sometimes for an hour and more, grim and restless. Urged on by desperate secretaries and associates and wife, he took vacations, but he didn't enjoy them. He was always anxious to get back, lest some chance for power pass him by. But upon his return, no chance would come. Things he had once enjoyed doing were less and less solace to him now. For no matter what he did, he could not get away from himself. To this man, who had consecrated his life to getting things done, to the getting and exercising of power, hell was the continued, urgent, desperate, insatiable need for accomplishment and power, combined with the inability to satisfy even a little part of that need. His muchachos did all they could to make life pleasant for him. Most of his muchachos. Most of them loved Robert Moses. Some of them loved Robert Moses only for what Robert Moses could do for them, and he couldn't do anything for them anymore. He had made up with George Spargo after the World's Fair and given his engineering firm contracts, but the loyal Harold Blake was to comment bitterly one day that Mr. Moses doesn't see much of George Spargo anymore, and Spargo was closer to Mr. Moses than anybody. Thanks to Sid Shapiro, who was still general manager and chief engineer of the Long Island State Park Commission, the big corner table in the marine dining room at Jones Beach was reserved for Moses and his party every Saturday and Sunday, and the chef would cook up something special, whatever Moses wanted. If it wasn't in stock at the restaurant, a patrol car would be sent screaming up to the mainland to get it. And whenever Moses went to the Marine Theater, which was frequently, there would be the introduction by Guy Lombardo and the spotlight and the unfailingly generous applause from the crowd above, and the opportunity for him to look unutterably bored by it all. The sea elf was kept always ready for him, gassed, manned, and stocked by the commission. Driving around the parks and parkways was still pleasant, for the senior officers at every facility were men who had served with R.M. when he had been the commission's president, and they treated him with the respect he remembered. Everybody connected with the commission, in fact, treated him with respect. When the author drove him down to meet Adam Karp, Moses told him to park in an area marked No Thoroughfare. After he left, the author was sitting there jotting down notes when a Long Island State Park Commission patrolman loomed in his window. "Don't you see the sign?" he asked with the usual LISPC arrogance. "Well, you see, I drove Mr. Moses down," the author began. "Oh," the cop said, straightening, and started to walk away without a word. Then he returned. "Thanks for telling me," he said. "I'd be out of work, and my children would be starving." There were bright spots in his life. On July 3, 1970, a handsome monument in a large plaza on the Lincoln Center campus of Fordham University was unveiled, a bronze bas-relief of Moses, executed by sculptor Albino Manca, mounted on a handsome three-sided slab of green marble over the words, chiseled and gilded in gold, "Robert Moses, Master Builder, Friend of Fordham." Terence Cardinal Cook blessed the monument. Nelson Rockefeller gave the principal address, calling Moses a man who built his own greatness. And as the Reverend Michael P. Walsh, president of Fordham, announced that the plaza would be named after him, long lines of state officials, Fordham priests, and old Moses men stood applauding with warm smiles on their faces until Moses had to bow his head to hide tears. To a man whose sensitivities had been rubbed as raw as Moses, however, there were unfortunate ironies even in this honor. In praising Moses, Rockefeller had, perhaps indelicately, alluded to the fact that up to now in the city, no public work has borne his name. Despite Fordham's touching and appreciated gesture, of course, that was still the case. This gesture wasn't an honor from the public he had served so long and so selflessly at such great self-sacrifice, but from a private institution. His name was immortalized in concrete and steel and parkland from one end of the state to the other, but it was on no public work in the city in which his efforts had been concentrated. It had been supposed to be on one, but it wasn't. And a plaza on a college campus wasn't quite the same thing as Flushing Meadows Park. There were other bright spots. He was Man of the Year for the Salvation Army and the Masons and the Society of Civil Engineers, for a dozen organizations between 1968 and 1972. A junior high school in Babylon was named after him, the 10th structure to bear his name. There were the ceremonies attendant on the completion of the public works that had been launched before the end of his Triborough chairmanship. In 1968, the huge new park on the landfill he had added to Randall's Island. In 1969, the lower level of the Verrazano Bridge. In 1970, the reconstruction of the Cross Bay Bridge. Ceremonies that gave him the opportunity to make speeches, and, now able to devote the necessary time to them, he delighted in writing them, so that their phrases had again the felicity and force of his speeches as a younger man. There were moments of triumph, such as his speech at the annual dinner of the Building Trades Employers Association in the grand ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in 1969, when, after Roger Corbetta of Corbetta Construction introduced him, "A great man, a great builder, a man of history, this great dirt mover, this master builder," the hundreds of men in the audience rose to their feet and cheered for long minutes. The Daily News gave good play to his pronouncements. When, in 1969, former Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall, urging the infusion of young blood into city planning, criticized the jaded planning of Robert Moses and said it had made New York an example of how not to conduct urban planning. The News replied, "We'd just like to observe that when Udall can show a list of accomplishments in power, transportation, and conservation 1/10 as long as Moses, it will be time enough for him to shoot off his yap." During the mayoral election of 1969, he backed the ultra-conservative Democratic candidate, Mario Procaccino. He preferred the more intellectual Republican candidate, John J. Marchi, also a conservative, but his endorsement, as always, was dictated by practicalities. He wanted a winner, someone who could return him to power, and he felt no Republican candidate could win in New York. Jeering at Lindsay as the glass of fashion and the mold of form and an utterly incompetent mayor, and declaring, "We are sick of amateurs who are not dry behind the ears." And the endorsement was in headlines on page one of the Times, as it had been in elections past. But the bright spots became fewer and fewer. The Cross Bay Bridge rebuilding was Robert Moses' last major construction project, the last with which he could occupy even a little of his time. And its opening celebration was the last at which he would be a leading figure. The requests to have him speak slowed from a torrent to a trickle, and by 1972 had dried up almost entirely. The mail, once so huge a bundle 3 times a day, fell off to almost nothing. There were continual discourtesies and humiliations. On May 22, 1969, the city dedicated Damrosch Park at the Guggenheim Bandshell at Lincoln Center. Damrosch Park had been conceived by Robert Moses. He had battled for the inclusion of the 2.34-acre open space in the Lincoln Center project when everyone else involved had opposed such waste of land. He had persuaded the Guggenheim and Damrosch families to donate the necessary funds. But he received only a form invitation to the opening ceremonies. Not only was there no invitation to speak, there was no place for him on the platform. He watched the ceremonies, presided over by Park Commissioner August Texture, whose primary contribution to Damrosch Park had been the approval of plans calling for lampposts on which the bulbs would be set 30 feet above the ground, too high for any of the department's bulb-changing equipment to reach, from a bench near the rear of the audience. Noticing him sitting there, Hexter asked him to come up and sit in a chair that happened to be vacant on the platform. "No thanks," Moses replied. He was preoccupied with immortality now. In one Newsday column, he said he was convinced that the finest short story ever written was Anatole France's The Procurator of Judea, which ends with Pontius Pilate saying, "Jesus? Jesus of Nazareth? I do not believe I can recall the name." And what roused him most to fury was the attempt of Lindsay and his bright young men to paint him as responsible for all the city's ills. Some of that criticism was unfair, predicated upon the ignorance of the new administration about the city it was supposed to be governing. Once, for example, the mayor criticized Moses for laying concrete through Alley Pond Park, which he implied had been a wonderful rustic nature spot before Moses came along and ruined it. Moses had ruined 100 rustic nature spots in New York City, but Alley Pond Park wasn't one of them. There hadn't been an Alley Pond Park until Moses came along and built it up out of an inaccessible, reeking marsh. The concrete Lindsay was talking about, the Cross Island Parkway, had been put through it at the same time. On another occasion, Lindsay said, "The Moses approach, where you take a bulldozer and mow people's houses down, just doesn't work in this city anymore. We get more done by working on smaller sites in cooperation with the community." Get more done. In his first 4 years in office, the total housing production of the Lindsay administration consisted of fewer units than Moses had been accustomed to produce every single year. But it was the reason Lindsay kept using his name that hurt Moses most. In some way he was totally unable to comprehend, his name, which had once been a symbol of the good in urban life, had become a symbol of the bad. When Lindsay's housing administrator, Jason R. Nathan, wanted to blast some new housing proposal, he simply said it was an example of
the Moses approach. Of all things, his reputation was now dearest to him, and it was his reputation that this incompetent mayor was destroying. And after a while, he couldn't even fight back. Always he had broadcast his views through mass mailings, of his letters, his memos, his press releases, his brochures, to hundreds if not thousands of influentials in city and state, mailings mimeographed by Triborough personnel or printed with Triborough funds, mailed with Triborough stamps. Whether or not it was made clear to him, as so many humiliating new restrictions on his activities were made clear to him by Ronan's men in the months after the MTA takeover, that Triborough printing and stamping privileges were no longer to be available to him in quantity, or whether it was simply that he was too proud to go on using resources that had not been offered to him, the fact remained that shortly after the MTA takeover, Moses' mailings were being addressed by hand and stamped with stamps purchased by him. Doing it that way was too much of a load even for three secretaries and his wife, who chipped in to help. The evidence was not on the front of the envelopes, which were typed as cleanly and neatly as ever, but on the back, the return address was printed on roughly by a stamp. Even that did not help enough. The mailings were reduced in size and then reduced again. Then, however, after another while, the workload was no longer such a problem, for there was almost nothing to mail. The principal ingredient of the mailings had been reprints of Moses' speeches and the column he wrote once a week for Newsday in syndication. Requests for him to speak were fewer in 1969 than they had been in 1968, and fewer still in 1970. By 1972, they were down to a handful. When his friend Harry Guggenheim sold Newsday to the Los Angeles Times Mirror Company in 1970, the column was discontinued. Now he had no public platform at all from which to voice his views or to reply to the criticism continually being heaped upon him. The column had, moreover, given him something to do. Now he had absolutely nothing to do. He grew terribly nervous. His big hands kept playing around his head, his fingers moving restlessly over his forehead. He kept putting his glasses on and taking them off. His fingers drummed on the table. Sitting, he would squirm nervously. He would jump up every few minutes and pace for a minute or two, sit down, jump up and pace again. He was almost desperate for something to do. It was principally for this reason that when the Daily News asked him to host a new television interview series, New York Close-Up, on its WPIX TV station, he agreed. He was not quite attuned to the blandness required in the medium, as he demonstrated conclusively even before his first program at a press conference called by WPIX-TV at the Overseas Press Club to announce the new show. Asked why Moses, who had no experience on TV, had been selected as host, the station's president, Fred M. Thrower, intoned, "There is no one in New York better suited to make an important contribution to New York and to television in the public affairs field." When reporters turned to Moses, he said with a grin, as the Times reported, "To tell the unvarnished truth, he was being hired because the various networks have decided to devote more time to public affairs in response to a demand on the part of Congress, the FCC, and others." A remark which prompted the Times reporter to remember that WPIX's license was being challenged by a rival group and that the FCC was scheduled to hold hearings on the two applications shortly. The programs were a fiasco, partly because Moses refused, except for a brief embarrassing attempt, to wear a hearing aid and, as a result, could not hear his guests' replies to his questions, partly because he was not interested in the replies anyway, and took up most of the program lecturing at the camera. After some 20 programs, he and the station jointly agreed to discontinue the series. His mind was as active as ever, ideas still churned out of it. To occupy his days, he agreed now to see people he had never seen before because he had felt they just wanted to pick his brains, use his ideas themselves, and get a fee out of it.
consultants from other countries and cities with specific problems on which they wanted his advice. And his imagination leaped as nimbly at these problems as the mind of the young Robert Moses had leaped at problems half a century and more before. The other day, Blake recalls, some man called who had been hired to do a study of what uses to make of Alcatraz Island. I mentioned it to him, and he starts to think, Alcatraz. The problems are very similar to Ellis Island. Very interesting. And boy, he was off to the races. He must have talked for an hour. One day, a delegation of 16 Japanese urban planners showed up to discuss a plan for, as Blake recalls it, linking up some little island to the mainland. Moses began asking questions. Then the yellow legal pad was pulled across his desk, and a pencil was in his hand. For more than 2 hours, the 16 Japanese sat transfixed as that pencil flew, and the big hand pounded the desk, and the big man jumped up and paced as the ideas took hold. On their way out, one of the Japanese said almost reverently, "A great man, a great man." There were so many ideas about things closer to home that needed doing. New parks for Long Island, new highways, his planned bridge. But now, not only could he do nothing about his ideas, he couldn't even tell anyone about them. He lived on slim hopes that Procaccino would defeat Lindsay and that Brennan and Van Arsdale could persuade Procaccino to return him to power, that Rockefeller would at last see through Ronan's obsequious flattery to what Moses felt was the incompetence beneath, that Rockefeller would win the presidency in 1968 and go to Washington, leaving Lieutenant Governor Malcolm Wilson in the governor's chair. "Malcolm Wilson is a great admirer of Mr. Moses, you know," Harold Blake would say. That Rockefeller would be given a cabinet position by Nixon in 1972 and thus place Wilson in the governor's chair. But in 1974, when Rockefeller resigned and Wilson did become governor, the only post offered to Moses was a meaningless one as a housing advisor to the governor. Rockefeller apparently still had enough influence to keep him out of any significant assignment. The Moses men were growing old. "He had so many people serving with him, and I see in my mind all these faces, dim now, like ghosts, and his face vivid, outlasting all of them," Sid Shapiro had said. R.M. had outlived one generation of aides. Now he was starting to outlive another. One after the other, they died. His bankers died. The younger one had gone first. Shanahan had been dead for years. In 1969, George McLaughlin died too. When an interviewer asked about the remaining aides, Shapiro said to him sadly, "You're talking about a bunch of white-haired old men now, you know. I remember when we were all young, out there at Belmont Lake." As long as Shapiro himself was still around, and in administrative charge of the Long Island State Park Commission, of course, the other deaths did not matter too much. Shapiro could still provide Moses with all the amenities that gave his life what happiness it had. This most loyal of men held on to the end, past the age when he might have retired, to make things easier for R.M. He held on even after he was told he had cancer. He held on until his pain and weakness made it impossible for him to work, even occasionally, any longer. And then, on April 12, 1972, he retired. Hoping for a while he might recover, he moved into a house on Oak Beach, right near that of the man he had served and worshipped for 50 years. His companionship was undoubtedly welcome, but the commissioners of the Long Island State Park Commission were now all men whom Moses knew only slightly. And as Shapiro's replacement, they selected not the Moses man next in line, Frank Champ, but an official of the National Park Service, and now there was no longer the deference to Moses in the parks he had created, or the introductions at the Marine Theater. Even the corner table at Jones Beach was no longer waiting. And after July 20, 1972, when Shapiro died, even the companionship of his oldest and most loyal aide was gone. Robert Moses, preoccupied with immortality, had no sons. He had 3 grandsons, 2 by his daughter Barbara, one by his daughter Jane. The one Barbara had named after him was mentally retarded. For her other son, John Olds, a Princeton graduate who married an heiress and became a banker, he had no use. Jane's son, Christopher Collins, was a tall, handsome youth with a broad, engaging grin and an easygoing nature. Unlike Jane's daughter, Caroline, a tall, brilliant girl who won honors at Oxford before getting married, from the time he began school, his grades were a problem, and he displayed no marked interest except in girls and surfing. He loved to spend the summers on the beach at Gilgo. "He's too good-looking for his own good," Jane said. But Robert Moses loved Chris. He doted on him, taking him with him everywhere. He taught him to fish and sail. With her husband long since out of the picture, he was supporting Jane, of course, and he saw that the boy always had plenty of pocket money. When Jane lost her temper with Chris over his grades, Chris would reply, "Gramps never says anything." Instead of an Ivy League university, he wanted to go to Little Chapel Hill College in North Carolina. Jane was appalled, but Moses told her, "Oh, let the boy go where he wants." When his first report card came back with straight C's, he said with a grin, "Well, at least he's consistent." In 1967, as a senior at college, Christopher Collins' attitude changed. His report card came back all A's. "I don't think R.M. was any prouder of the Verrazano Bridge than he was of that report card," Sid Shapiro says. When Chris said that he wanted to study law at Stanford, Moses helped him get in. On December 11, 1968, driving home to Long Island from California as a passenger in a car driven by a Stanford friend, Christopher Collins, 21, was killed when the car veered off the road and smashed into a concrete culvert. Once he had had battalions to boss and on which to demonstrate his administrative ability. Now he had only his secretaries and chauffeur, so he did so on them. He was harsh and abrupt and arrogant in talking to them and about them. Explaining how he had gotten caught the day before in a traffic jam, he said, "The chauffeur took the wrong route. He always takes the wrong route if he's left alone, and I never interfere. That's his business. He's the chauffeur. If you don't like it, you get another chauffeur." He became a name-dropper, trying consciously to lard his conversation with the names of great men he had known. Still, he lived on, year after year, vital and alert, imaginative and energetic, but with nothing to do with his vitality, his imagination, and his energy, except to bottle them up, feeding on himself. His name had faded from the headlines in New York City long before. For a while after Newsday no longer published his column, its reporters still telephoned him for comment on stories involving public works on Long Island and played his statements prominently, as did the Long Island Press. But as time went on, that all but stopped too. This man, who for decades had read the newspapers first thing every morning, no longer found his name in them, except on rare occasions, and on those occasions almost invariably in a derogatory context, as a man who had been responsible for housing and highway mistakes. He had built Jones Beach and Sunken Meadow State Park, and Hexter and the Messina and St. Lawrence power projects, but no one remembered those. He was forgotten, to live out his years in bitterness and rage. In private, his conversation dwelt more and more on a single theme, the ingratitude of the public toward great men. And once, invited by the church to speak at the dedication in Flushing Meadows Park of the Exedra, a huge marble bench for reflection donated by the Roman Catholic Diocese of New York, he gave vent to his feeling in public. Turning to a high church official who was also an old friend, his voice booming out over the public address system, he said, "Someday, let us sit on this bench and reflect on the gratitude of man." Down in the audience, the ministers of the Empire of Moses glanced at one another and nodded their heads. "R.M. was right, as usual," they whispered. "Couldn't people see what he had done?"
Why weren't they grateful? This is Robertson Dean. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York, by Robert A. Caro, Volume 3. Executive